Systems Initiative for the year. And our speaker today is Dr. David Miller from the National Energy Technology Laboratory. I'm very pleased that he could come today. Dr. Miller receives a PhD from Ohio State University, working with some very interesting data. And then spent some time at Michigan Tech University, and then also at Roseforman University, Indiana. And at that time, he was working on process optimization, especially for energy systems and process synthesis. He's been at NETL here for, I guess, almost 2 years. He has been heading up the Carbon Capture and Sequencing Initiative. And so he's going to be telling us about some of the initiatives and the activities there, especially about carbon capture and how that interacts with process synthesis. So, David, it's all yours. Thank you for coming.
Okay, thank you. Can everybody on the phone here okay?
Yep.
Okay, good. So, I have no idea why this little sound bar keeps popping up here. Something about that. See if that gets better, if it gets completely annoying, I'm going to talk a little bit about fossil energy systems and carbon capture, and give you an idea of what it is that I intend to talk about. I'll give you a brief review of NETL, which is the National Energy Technology Laboratory, which is one of the newer national labs. We'll go over some definitions and an overview of power production, just so that we're all on the same page when we start talking about carbon capture and some of the process synthesis and optimization opportunities. We'll view the motivations in terms of carbon CO2 cost and how that also relates to water use. Review some of the post-combustion carbon capture technology, and then dig into some of the process synthesis design and optimization approaches and results that we've gotten so far that I'm able to share. And then finally, wrap up with some concluding remarks and a brief description of future work. So the National Energy Technology Laboratory is one of the Department of Energy's national laboratories. The NETL has three major locations where we actually conduct research, and those are in Pittsburgh, in Morgantown, West Virginia, and Albany, Oregon. There's also field offices in Fairbanks, Alaska, and Fargo, Texas, which primarily monitor DC project management with industry. And one of the things that characterizes NETL is we actually have a lot of industry and academic collaboration in doing our research and conducting our projects. The lab has been around for 100 years. You can cite the origins back in 1910, and just last week there was a big kickoff meeting for the RUA and beginning of the year celebration here in Pittsburgh that several people might have attended. And we've been involved in climate and energy change research in the area of climate change and energy since the early 1990s. Just to give you some idea of what the Office of Research and Development at NETL does and what it consists of, we've got approximately 200 federal employees and 200 contractor employees. We work closely with our regional university alliance, which includes Carnegie Mellon, University of Pittsburgh, Penn State, Virginia Tech, and West Virginia University. Greater than 90 faculty involved with various projects, about 139 graduate students and postdocs that we support, and in addition, we've got over 60 students and postdocs that we support through our ORI program. These are people that are working directly at the lab with fellow researchers, and we've published a lot of papers and had a lot of citations, and there's recently been a lot of that. Over the last several years. one of the primary focuses at the lab, and this is probably 80-90% of what the research focuses on, is activities to reduce the carbon footprint in fossil energy production. And do that through a number of different types of projects. One area is looking at trying to increase the efficiency in power production by looking at advanced steam cycles, advanced gasification methods, different types of combustion turbines, as well as fuel cells, looking at fuel flexibility, so being able to include some biomass with coal as a raw material energy production system, and then also looking at carbon capture technology. The goals that NETL and the Department of Energy have are for greater than 90% carbon capture from the flue gas or in case of gasification from a pre-combustion system with minimal increase in cost of electricity. So now we'll move on and talk briefly about some definitions and overview of different types of power plants and different ways that we can generate power so that we can understand the types of carbon capture systems that we'll be looking at. So, first off, you can divide power production facilities into several different categories, and so we're going to focus on fossil energy systems. Okay, so that rules out things like nuclear and hydropower and solar. And within fossil energy systems, there are single-cycle systems and two-cycle systems. So a single-cycle system would be something like a pulverized coal plant, and what it's basically doing is you're burning coal, generate steam, steam runs turbines, and the turbines generate electricity. This is a 19 cycle. There are three primary classifications of CC plants. There's a subcritical plant, and that would have a steam pressure that's running the turbines at approximately 2,500 psi, and then range somewhere between 36% to 40% thermal efficiency. And that can vary a little bit, partly depending upon how you define efficiency. Many and most of the existing pulverized coal fleets within the United States are subcritical plants. Newer plants are often supercritical plants. Supercritical again refers to the steam pressure. These are at a typically higher pressure, up around 3,500 psia. And running at that higher pressure, you get greater thermal efficiency in the range of 40% to 45% thermal efficiency. And recently, there have been efforts to build ultra-supercritical plants, which run at a still higher steam pressure and can have a higher efficiency still. The challenge with these types of plants is the materials of construction have difficulty surviving at these higher pressures and temperatures, so there's a materials problem associated with that. So all of these types of PC-type plants, if you were to go about reducing the carbon footprint of that and capturing the CO2 that's generated from burning the coal, it would apply typically a post-combustion capture process. Basically, it's amine capture, typically with monoethanol amine and perhaps some stabilizers, as the current technology most closely ready for commercial deployment. However, it's very costly. And we'll see later on, there are a number of potential other types of post-combustion technology that could be applied. The other type of single-cycle power plant that is used within the U.S. is a gas turbine, and that uses a single breaking cycle. It has some advantages over a CC plant in the fact that it tends to have very low capital costs, so it's pretty cheap and easy to put up a gas turbine and burn it. The gas turbine, the exhaust gas is turn a turbine to generate electricity. However, it's got higher operating costs. It's used typically for peaking power. When, for example, all of a sudden a bunch of people throw on their air conditioners at the same time and rapidly need additional electricity, the gas turbine can rapidly spin up and deliver that electricity, whereas the cycle time for a pulverized coal plant can be on the order of days to actually bring it up to a higher level or ramp it back down. there are also the combined cycle type plants. The one that you probably have heard the most of is an IGCC, which is an integrated gas system combined cycle. And essentially the way this operates is you gasify coal to make syngas, which is essentially a mixture of CO, hydrogen, and CO2, plus some other stuff. And so to get the electricity from the combined cycle, you burn the syngas in a gas turbine, which is the burning cycle, and you generate steam from cooling the syngas, and also from the turbine exhaust, which is the Rankine cycle. And combining these two cycles together, you can have a much higher efficiency of the overall plant. The downside of IGCC plants is capital cost is extremely exorbitant. And so you may have heard that Duke Energy has been building a plant in southern Indiana where the capital costs have essentially doubled, and a significant cost overrun associated with that. And at one point, FutureGen was going to be a gasification plant for demonstration project, and now that's using other technologies. Here's the reduced carbon footprint of an IGCC. Typically would employ a quick combustion capture approach. So that would entail using a HIP reactor to shift the syngas gas to be primarily hydrogen and carbon dioxide. And then most approaches that are close to commercialization would use a physical solvent to remove the CO2, such as the Solectrol or Rectisol process. And then you have the hydrogen stream, which you can then burn in a gas turbine, or in a gas turbine that's been modified to burn hydrogen. Natural gas combined cycle is the other type of combined cycle plant. You don't have to gasify anything because natural gas is already a gas. So it tends to have much lower capital costs than IGCC, but you still have a lot higher efficiency. It has less CO2-based emissions inherently, just because of the increased efficiency and the ratio of hydrogen to carbon in the fuel that you're using. And so if you wanted to capture the fuel, you're coming off of that, you would use one of the post-combustion carbon capture technologies that you would also employ typically, or most likely, with a PV plant. Just in case your knowledge and memory of thermodynamics is a little rusty, this is a real quick example of the Rankine cycle and also a Brayton cycle. So the Rankine cycle, essentially we are putting heat in, making steam, that steam turns the turbine, and then we've got a condenser to crank that steam back into liquid water, to pump that up to pressure, turn it back into steam, and that's essentially the Rankine cycle. And so you can follow that essentially running also on the temperature entropy diagram. Basic idea of a Brayton cycle. It's similar. Take fresh air, you compress that up to a higher pressure, combine that with the fuel, combust that, then the hot gases expand. The expansion of those gases can turn turbine in order to get work out, which can be turned into electricity, and then you get those hot exhaust gases. Combining the two, these hot exhaust gases can then be used as a source of heat back here in the Rankine cycle. And so, to just finish up slide 11, if anybody's not able to get on the web, you might be on the audio, I apologize for not telling the slide number.
Now we're doing okay.
All right. Okay, so post-combustion capture, essentially the way these systems are configured, you combine fuel and air and the boiler, and that's the electricity, you turn it into a turbine, you just make power. The fuel gas comes out, and it's roughly 13% CO2 with a lot of nitrogen at fairly low pressure, fairly low temperatures. You want to capture that using some process that you need to determine in order to get the CO2 stream. And once you capture 90% of stream 13 mole percent CO2, there's going to be about 1.5 mole percent CO2 in the nitrogen stream or the exit stream that would be coming out. So you're dealing with very low driving forces, which are one of the particular challenges for the post-combustion capture system. Another approach for burning coal would be to use oxy-combustion, and in oxy-combustion, instead of separating out, that's on slide 12, the nitrogen after you burn the coal, you separate out the nitrogen in advance, so you're basically burning fuel with oxygen, and then typically recycling some of the CO2, so as to keep the total temperature in the boiler down, so that you don't turn the boiler into a pile of molten metal. And then the CO2 comes out relatively pure. There's still a number of sulfur compounds and heavy metals, as well as moisture that would need to be removed from that before you could do something such as sequestration of that CO2. Oxy-combustion is the technology that's being demonstrated in Futuregen 2.0, and there are a number of vendors who are working on developing oxy-combustion systems. And then the third type of carbon capture technology, in general, would be for pre-combustion capture. And so typically with a gasifier, and on slide 14, to combine fuel with oxygen coming from an air separation unit, much like in the case of combining, much like in the oxy-combustion case. About the gasifier and then also perhaps the shift reactor, so to get clean gas, which is primarily a mixture of hydrogen and CO2. This tends to be at a much higher temperature and a much higher pressure, which makes actually, as well as the CO2, at a much higher concentration, typically in the range of 40%, which makes removing that CO2 and separating it from the hydrogen much more straightforward and less costly. Take the hydrogen to the combustion turbine to generate power and perhaps get some additional heat that can be used for the steam cycle as part of that combined cycle activity. So these are the major sort of general approaches for looking at reducing carbon footprint associated with fossil energy systems. And so we'll move on and talk a little bit about the motivation for moving the primarily post-combustion system, some of the cost analyses that have been performed so far, and talk a little bit about how water actually plays an important role in all of this as well. Before moving on, are there any questions anybody has about the background? I went through that kind of quickly, but I assume that this is very, very familiar to most everybody. Okay. So this is a plot of U.S. CO2 emissions from coal-fired power plants. We've got the emissions for 2010, which were an estimate based upon the end of 2009. And generating capacity from coal plants at that point was about 313 gigawatts of electricity, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,800 million metric tons of CO2 per year. And this red area, over the next 25 years, is projected to be, on an annual basis, the emissions from existing power plants. So power plants, coal-fired power plants that are already on the ground, and over the next 25 years, that's fairly significant. New power plants that would be built are this green area, and so 25 years from now, that might be a significant amount of CO2 emissions, but primarily, if we're going to have an impact on reducing the CO2 emissions from coal-fired power plants, something needs to be done that can be applied to the existing fleet of coal-fired power plants. Basically this red area in order to try to drive the emissions down. Right. Currently, there are two small IGCC plants in the United States generating power as their primary product. So, focusing a lot on pre-combustion carbon capture technology to apply to this existing fleet is not going to necessarily address the immediate need to hopefully have to reduce CO2 emissions. Alright, so most of this 1,800 million metric tons of CO2 per year are coming from CC plants. So subcritical and supercritical CC plants that already exist. According to estimates that have been done by NHL's Office of Systems Analysis and Planning, which is a group of NHL that essentially runs or performs large scale and energy balances of different plant configurations and tries to estimate costs and net efficiency for different types of IGCs, subcritical PC plants, and supercritical PC plants to see what they estimate the efficiency of these plants to be. Average IGCC is about 40% efficient without carbon capture. Subcritical PC plants, they estimate about 37% efficient without carbon capture. And supercritical, they estimate about 39% efficient. And if they apply current state-of-the-art carbon capture technology, which in the case of IGCC would be a cholesterol process, the efficiency drops to 32%. In the case of subcritical PC plant or supercritical PC plant, this would be applying an aqueous engineering type scrubber, and engineering amine, a monoethanol amine, then the efficiency drops to about 25% for the subcritical PC plant and about 27% for the supercritical PC plant. And a lot of this drop in efficiency in all of these cases is because you need to extract a fuel from the fuel cycle in order to run the carbon capture process. And you also need to extract some of the electricity or some of the power from the steam turbines that would otherwise be generating electricity to compress the CO2 up to a pressure that's high enough that you can put it into a pipeline in order to turn it off to sequestration at some point. All right, so these numbers are probably pretty bad. So we need to come up with better ways to reduce the carbon footprint associated with these plants. The Office of Systems Analysis and Planning has also done some estimation of costs and the breakdown of those costs in terms of minimum per kilowatt hour. So this is the levelized cost of electricity. So it includes annualizing capital costs, and then also includes the operating costs, and then the total amount of power that would be generated from that plant. And so for an average IGC, without carbon capture, that's about 78, and for a subcritical PC plant, or a supercritical PC plant, the cost of electricity is significantly lower. Okay, so about 64 mils per kilowatt hour and 63 mils per kilowatt hour. However, when you start adding the cost of carbon capture system, the additional fuel that you would need to burn to make the same amount of electricity because the efficiency is now so much lower, then, at least according to this analysis, then an IGCC plant on average becomes less expensive, 106 mils compared to 118.5 and 115 or so per kilowatt hour.
Yeah, I think that's the point being, David, that the new plants, it seems like IPCC is very favorable. Existing plants, something else has to be done.
Yeah, something else has to be done, and the technology, this is based upon NEA7. At least this analysis says NEA7 is probably not the way to go either.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly, these are studies based upon, essentially one data point that have a lot of assumptions that go into that one data point. And these numbers may or may not be completely accurate because some of those assumptions may be less valid than other assumptions. And the other case is in all of these plants, these are not optimized designs. These are designs that has just been pretty vacant. Here's a quote for MEA type shoving system in the case of a PC plant. Let's stick it on the back end and add up all the costs, and this is what we have as the cost of our plant. And there are a lot of scaling factors, and there are potentially significant room for optimization to be applied to these systems. And that's what we'll take a look at later on, some preliminary results that show that indeed optimization could play a significant role, and in addition, we perhaps need to come back to some of the assumptions that are apparent in these designs. I should probably also throw in the caveat that many of the opinions expressed here in this talk are my opinions and do not necessarily reflect the views of the United States government or the Department of Energy. Okay, so with that said, Office of Systems Analysis and Planning has also looked at water use as applied to these different types of technologies for both the IGCC case, looking at PE-type gasifiers, and for Phillips-type gasifiers, and Shell-type gasifiers, and for subcritical and supercritical type CC plants. Now, the dark bars on the left are the amount of water that is estimated to be used in terms of gallons per minute per megawatt net that's being produced by a plant. And the light bars to the right are the estimated water use with carbon capture technology. And so the big numbers here are over here in the pulverized pole, where it appears that water use would likely double with the use of methane carbon capture technology. And most of that water use is estimated to be on water evaporation. From the increased cooling requirements for the system. So NEPL's goals and the Department of Energy's goals for carbon capture and reducing fresh water usage, we want to be able to capture 90% of the CO2, and we want to do that with minimal increases in the cost of electricity. And so for a PC plant, we don't want the cost of electricity to be more than 30% more than without carbon capture. And for IGCC, we don't want it to be more than 10% more than without carbon capture. And there are also goals to reduce fresh water withdrawal and consumption by more than 50% by ready for commercial demonstration by 2015 at a cost savings of more than 25%. Compared to just using dry cooling. You don't necessarily have to use cooling water to cool things down. You can use air-cooled heat exchangers to cool things down, but you tend to lose some efficiency and therefore and also have higher capital cost requirements when doing that. So that becomes the basis of comparison is state-of-the-art dry cooling. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the post-combustion carbon capture technology, and we'll take a look at a little more detail of what actually a CC plant consists of and what are some of the parts that might give us some opportunity to combine that in a more creative fashion with some of these post-combustion capture technologies. So a subcritical CC plant, just to start off with, essentially consists of a boiler, where we're bringing in cool coal and preheated air, and we're burning that and that coal in order to create steam. And typically we create steam in two ways. We've got the subsurface plant, there's the boiler that creates the initial steam, which then goes to high pressure turbines, and then that steam is typically returned to the boiling to be reheated before going to intermediate pressure turbine and then low pressure turbine. Flue gas typically used to help preheat the incoming air. Typically it's filtered through a baghouse or an electrostatic precipitator and then goes through a depulverization process through which typically combines wine, water, and makes the gypsum as kind of the end product there. In the steam cycle, there are typically steam extractions between the different turbines that go to boil the steam water heater system. And as you follow the steam through the steam turbine, eventually that goes to a condenser to create liquid water, which is then increased in pressure to a pump, and then preheated, and then back in here, is deaerated, potentially pressurized higher, and then goes back into the boiler system. So you can pull out steam at any one of these points in between the turbines and potentially use some of that to preheat our seawater. And this is also where we would pull out steam depending upon what temperature and pressure you would need it at in order to make use of that in our capture process. And then within the condenser itself, that's typically run off cooling water, which is essentially a leak with a cooling tower to return the water to a lower temperature, and this is where most of the water losses will occur within the plant. Or at least the most significant water losses. All right, so the first technology, and sort of the standard default technology, is aqueous amine scrubbing. And essentially, that consists of a flue gas cooler, potentially a vapor liquid separator to knock out some of the converted water. That water is then used to rest in a scrubber on top of the absorber. The bulk of the flue gas is then entered in an absorber, which contacted with and roughly 30% by weight, 10 grade solution in water. A flue gas would then typically go to a scrubber to remove any amine that's been entrained or volatilized in the absorber system. And then you have, you know, between the flue gas departing, the lip stream, and the air with the CO2 absorbed in it, then contacted with the heater, transfer heat from between the lip stream and the lean stream. And then entering the scrubber, which has a condenser and reboiler, to then strip off the CO2. The CO2 would then enter a compression train in order to be compressed and sequestered, or at least in the early stages of deployment, might actually go for EOR, which might actually be revenue positive. And then the in-stream is recycled back to the absorber. Solid absorbents are another technology that are being evaluated for use in carbon capture systems. One of the potential advantages of a solid absorbent system compared to the aqueous amine impact system. So going back to slide 23, with the aqueous amine system, we've got a lot of water that's going around between the absorber and the stripper that's being heated and cooled, and also being vaporized and condensed with the system breaker and the stripper. So using a lot of energy that we might not have to if we had a solid absorbent system where we didn't have the water being transported back and forth as well. There are a number of different absorbent systems that are being explored, two of which have been developed at NETL, one is Pittsburgh site, and one is the Morgantown site. This is just an impregnated amine. In Morgantown, the amine are impregnated into a bentonite clay type structure. And in Pittsburgh, the absorbent, the amines are actually chemically fastened onto a steam silica. So those are two of the general classes of amine based solid absorbent. What's not clear yet is exactly how these amine-based solid absorbents could best be put into a reactor system and used to capture the CO2. So one idea is using a moving bed. Another major idea is using a fluidized bed, potentially a fast fluidized bed or a bubbling fluidized bed, in order to provide a contacting between gas and the solid, and then separate those, and then again, the solid sorbents, just like the aqueous moon, have to regenerate the sorbents, so the sorbents can go back into the absorber, and then regenerate your mostly your CO2 stream, which could then be sequestered. There's a lot of work at the NHGL on studying different types of reactive systems that could be used for solid vapor type contacting, including use of CFC, and these are some CFC reactive simulation results for a CFC type system. And in addition to impregnated type solid sorbent, other people are looking at things such as calcium oxide as a possible solid sorbent, that is running at much higher operating temperatures, potentially, and there are a number of different systems that are under investigation. People are looking at membranes as another way to separate the CO2 from flue gas, and this is a simple schematic of a project that a couple of different companies are exploring with some support from NHGL, and my research group is actually working on developing some models to help see whether or not these processes are really as good as the vendors are indicating that they might be, and also then to be able to potentially apply some optimization. So the idea is that a flue gas comes out of the boiler and goes to what we do, flue gas desulfurization unit, gets compressed and goes to the first membrane unit, and then the CO2, when partially diffuses through the membrane, along with some additional nitrogen and some other gases, primarily nitrogen, is compressed again and goes into another membrane system, where then you get mostly pure CO2 coming out, which would then be dehydrated and go off to sequestration. And then the tentate from that process goes back to the first membrane, and the tentate from the first membrane goes to the membrane system here, where the flow from the CO2 would diffuse through the membrane and increase the CO2 concentration in the boiler by having the sea crack or some of the air that's going into the boiler go across the membrane. Looking at oxyfuel, the idea behind oxyfuel, as I mentioned before, is if you just burn in sort of oxygen atmosphere, then theoretically you end up with a very concentrated stream of CO2 that could be relatively easy to capture. Some of the things that need to happen to make this more commercially viable is to integrate the oxygen production with the rest of the actual power production system, as opposed to buying a separate air separation unit on the front end. One of the other things that becomes very interesting with oxycombustion is because you're changing the atmosphere inside of the boiler by recycling the CO2, you've got a large concentration of CO2 instead of nitrogen. The heat transfer properties and the rate of this heat transfer becomes markedly different. And that's one of the things that the NHGL is also investigating with some of the CFC analysis, which is one of the major components of our research program. And another potentially longer range technology that's of great interest to NHGL is chemical looping. This is a very similar idea to some of the concepts with solid sorbent and some of the concepts with oxycombustion. And so what it essentially consists of is sort of using an air separation unit to create the oxygen that you're doing the combustion with. You react a metal with air to make a metal oxide. And so you get a solid metal oxide particle that then comes over to the fuel reactor, and in the fuel reactor, the oxygen is released from that metal oxide and reacts with the fuel to make CO2. This has been demonstrated for gaseous systems and with solid fuel type systems. There's some additional challenges associated with that, such as trying to contact a solid metal oxide or a solid fuel particle and getting those to react or getting the oxygen to be released from the metal oxide to the oxygen and the solid fuel particle and be removed. And there's an increasing interest in these types of systems. It has the potential to significantly reduce the cost of making carbon, reduce carbon electricity and energy. Most of the metal oxides that are being considered for this are what are called commodity carriers, so they're things that are pretty much you can dig out of the ground and clean them up a little bit and make use of them, as opposed to like a solid sort of capture system. Most of the best working systems for those are relatively expensive to make the solid sort of particle themselves. And then, of course, at the back end, there's a suppression system, which tends to, in most cases, to be an afterthought, but it's actually a very important part of the process. It uses a lot of energy, and depending upon how you build and configure this sort of suppression system, you could potentially have access to a lot of the energy which would otherwise be lost in these inner coolers. And if you have higher suppression ratios and potentially have a higher temperature steam coming out of the compressor, it could then be heat integrated with some aspect of the rest of the process. And there's some companies working with NHL on compressors with fixed compression ratios of up to 12:1, which then you have about a 500-degree steam coming out of the compressors. It's much more usable energy than you could with a typical insulator at the temperature of the 50°C. All right, so in the last 20 minutes, we'll talk about some aspects of process synthesis design and optimization, the approach that MCL is taking to that in collaboration with some of you here, and take a look at some of the results that demonstrate, compared to those numbers that I said at the beginning of the talk, why optimization is going to be such an important aspect of carbon capture technology. So to summarize some of the challenges associated with carbon capture itself, there's estimated about 2 billion tons of CO2 from coal will be generated in 2020 just in the United States, just for power production, if nothing is done to reduce the carbon footprint of a coal-fired power plant. And a single CCU plant puts out about 5 million pounds per hour of flue gas,
which is a fairly large amount of flue gas to process
for just one power plant. As we've seen, there's really no existing economical solution. There's not a framework in place elsewhere for developing, evaluating, optimized design. There's general difficulty in reusing existing models and simulations. And if you go to the literature and pull out any bill reports and reports from other places, you'll find that it's very difficult to compare any of the numbers, because there's a number of different evaluation methods and inconsistent assumptions. And so the approach that we're taking is an integrated approach that applies process synthesis and design and optimization all together. Looks at process integration, which is the of the nonlinear interactions across units and subsystems, and also employs some aspects of simulation-based optimization and multi-criteria decision-making, because, as we saw early on, it's not just a cost issue, but there's also efficiency and water use that we want to be able to optimize. And so that brings us to the modular framework for process design and optimization, which entails in the process of building, and what this eventually will consist of are a number of modules for different types of existing plants and parts of the existing plant. We have primarily the PC plant, modules for the IPC component further down the road, modules for the different types of post combustion capture systems, including amines, solid sorbents, azote and oxycombustion membranes, and some boulder are things that we're currently actively developing models for, as well as the compression system, and then also for pre-combustion, and we're also doing some work in the area of water treatment, non-traditional water sources, so that we can better evaluate different ways to look at the water use aspect of carbon capture systems. So within the modular framework itself, there are a number of different activities that are being employed. One area of work is looking at derivative free optimization algorithms and applying those to different combinations of these modules, putting them together. We're doing some work in the area of sequence structure development, and maybe better be able to do cluster synthesis and deep integration. And another project ongoing to develop certain models and simulations that many of these modules are based upon. Develop algebraic models from those, and then the algebraic models that we use with those such as GAMs or GAN and so forth as far as the superstructure optimization approach. So it's kind of a multi-pronged approach to looking at a number of different aspects of carbon capture and how to put these different systems together and how to integrate them.
So,
One aspect of being able to put these things together is a simulation interface that we call Sinter. Many of these modules are being built in Aspen, either Aspen Plus or Aspen Custom Modeler, and Sinter allows them to be interacted with by the modular framework part of the derivative free optimization algorithm for the development of surrogate models. And so forth, and provide them a means for them to link these different modules together. And simply, it's essentially based upon a visual basis, being able to interact with the Aspen code, and then put the results into Excel, which then can be fairly easily interacted with by other types of programs. And we can also do additional post-processing of the information that's coming out of the simulation, such as the estimate of cost and the objective function calculation. So, and as one demonstration, the modular framework, we put together a subcritical PC power plant, actually several modules, linked to CO2 capture module, which is an MEA process, and a compression module, which is essentially a five-pacing type compressor, which actually consists of 10 compression stages. Some of the numbers that I'll show are a little bit out of date because we've gotten some updated information about the compression model itself and some data functions that we were using. But one of the important things is when we take a look at these results, these numbers are at least consistent with the 2007 bicumulus baseline study that all the cost numbers and water use numbers earlier in the presentation were based on. And so what we've done is run a number of different optimization runs looking at different ways to design and configure and integrate the PC plant carbon capture system, which is an MEA-based system, and the compression system, and we've gone and calculated and used our objective functions, water use in terms of pounds per megawatt hour net, and capital costs in terms of dollars per megawatt net. And what we've seen is we can actually drive within the design space towards these red dots down here, which is a Pareto plant. This is the optimal trade-off for this optimization scenario between water use and capital cost per megawatt. Yeah, now, very interestingly, you know, this shows that someone in the neighborhood of $1 to $1.2 million per megawatt net power. And so that objective function actually allows us to compare and improve both the capital cost. So being expecting something bigger, you know, it's not necessarily what we want to do, but also by including megawatt net and net power production, we get the parasitic power load. So you can kind of look at the trade-off between the capital cost and operating cost sort of partially within this one objective function. Now compared to the baseline studies, capital costs are actually somewhere out in here. And the baseline study for water use is somewhere up around 7,000. So baseline numbers from that 2007 report are somewhere up about here with this non-optimal, non-integrated design. And we use all the same assumptions, and at least as far as we can track, that we use it in that study. So we're not trying to grid this. And you know, we could get some designs out there as well, but there's obviously some better designs. And we also looked at the comparison between capital cost, again, in terms of dollars per megawatt net, and the net unit heat rate. Net unit heat rate is essentially the power industry's fancy way of talking about efficiency. It's in terms of BTU input, so BTU input is the coal coming into the plant, divided by the kilowatt hours net coming out of the plant. And they turn it over and make it a big number because it's a whole lot nicer to talk about a net unit heat rate in terms of 10,000 than a 30% plant efficiency, which doesn't sound so nearly so good. And again, the carbon capture is about 9,000, and the net unit heat rate with carbon capture. It was significantly more. So again, we're talking about numbers that are out here, but just the optimization, and not even tremendously rigorous optimization, and there's certainly a lot more that could be done. This is just an initial demonstration to show how important it is for optimization to be considered. And net unit heat rate and water use actually follow the same trend, and so we end up coming down there, but they tend to be correlated quite a bit. So I can sort of summarize these results briefly in this slide, and just so that the net unit heat rate varies a bit, and so you typically want that number to be as low as possible, a low net unit heat rate is better. And the capital cost down considerably low. Again, this is about $14,000 per kilowatt net for the baseline study. And we've broken that down. And this is a 550 megawatt plant when we started, and roughly 200 megawatts of that plant are locked in the parasitic load for being captured, so the ultimate cost of the increase in cost of electricity becomes significantly higher. And so, since we're starting to go low on time, I would say, bounce ahead to some major conclusions we can draw at this point with respect to the process synthesis design and optimization of carbon capture systems. It's very important for actually optimizing the system in order to be able to compare and evaluate the different processes, because there's a large potential improvement over these initial designs. There are a lot of non-intuitive interactions, and there are a lot of significant optimization immigration opportunities, especially if you consider the wide range of additional carbon capture systems and or areas such as IPCC, and also including the compression when thinking about the future technology area that's going to be very important to the long-term availability of inexpensive clean power, not just in the United States, but also around the world. And so I'll digress for just a minute here at the end. We kind of focus on this process synthesis and design aspect of as the one very important task required for ultimately being able to deploy at the demonstration scale and ultimately commercial scale carbon capture technology. And really, process synthesis and design is only one aspect of the things that need to actually happen in order to get to the point where we can build these on a large scale. There also needs to be particle and device scale models, such as some of the CFD models that I showed in some of the earlier slides, to make a good understanding of how some of these devices will actually work and some aspects of the detailed design. And you might support that with design of a distillation column, as sort of a simple example. We can do all sorts of things with process synthesis stage to understand big levers on the cost and the process. But if you don't get the holes in the slip trays right and the gears right, then the unit's not going to behave properly. So the other side, there's also a lot of aspects of process operations, such as the dynamics of these processes, how you control these processes, how you make them operable, that are also part of the overall process of designing one of these things and deploying it, as well as all the basic data. How do you understand the uncertainties in the models and the design so that ultimately you can analyze the risk and be sufficiently confident to make the decision to go forward? And this whole concept is part of a new initiative within DOE called the Carbon Capture Simulation Initiative that we'll be kicking off here later this month, next week in fact. Where the goal is to be able to accelerate learning during deployment and development by identifying chemical concepts, designing optimal systems, and quantifying the technical risks in those systems. And we'll be working not only with university partners, but also with a number of different national labs on this project. And so to conclude, I'll just summarize this slide with and acknowledges members of my research team. This includes a number of people here at Carnegie Mellon. Otherwise, the process synthesis and design aspect couldn't be moving forward nearly as well as it is. With that, I'll conclude, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that remain in the time remaining.
Good. And maybe we could start with Jeff. Jeff, do you have any questions out there?
No, that's okay. Got it.
Okay, very good. Well, other questions in the room, Jeff?
Yes.
So, and then, for example, I think it's in slide number 16. So, I need to look at the recent So, if we look at the embrace of power output from 2010 to 2035. That's more like it's from 312 to 324, which is more like 4%. And then if you look at the million metric tons per year that we're going to be able to now 2010 to 2035, it goes from what, like 1800 to 2200, or something like that, maybe 2100. So what you have is like 20% increase. So it looks like if we make the ratio of how much power we're getting per unit of ton of CO2, it looks like we're going to actually going to need more CO2 to 2035. So you know, it looks like you're going to increase the emission of CO2 more than the increase of power. So more than,
yeah.
guess I'll go ahead.
Okay. Well, yeah, I...
But here's my quick guess and an answer without pulling out the data that I used to create this. I think this is generating capacity, not necessarily all being run flat out. And again, this is generating capacity, not necessarily being run flat out. And so if the CO2 emissions are expected to increase more than the generating capacity, that would mean that we're actually using more of the generating capacity than we are currently using to increase the emissions.
Okay. Yeah, do you have a comment on that?
What was the flight that showed the amount of CO2 in number?
16.
What? Huh?
16. Doesn't fit battery well, but maybe the battery's still loaded. Anyway, the 312.9 and the 3.45 in terms of generating capacity at the two ends of the curve, compared to the 1,800 to roughly 2,200 million metric tons of CO2 per year.
Oh, okay.
So when you look at it in terms of million metric tons of CO2 per year per gigawatt hour or per gigawatt generating capacity, it increases more than the generating capacity.
Yeah, I'm actually almost putting that right. Okay, it's going to actually decrease as IPCC turns out to be more efficient than what we're installing.
But I think the numbers are actual CO2 emissions, and the gigawatt numbers are installed capacity.
Yeah, I think that you're probably right about that.
Okay. So essentially 22% increase in CO2 and 4% increase in power.
In power capacity.
Capacity.
From coal.
Well, this is all from coal.
Because most of the new power capacity won't be coal.
Well, this is power capacity for coal. So everything on the chart should be
coal.
So basically, I think the answer to the question is that instead of building a new coal power plant, the existing ones will be run to a higher capacity, and as the red line decreases, those less efficient plants that are dispatched less often will be taken out of the mix.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I was wondering if, in terms of retrofit, how easy or how difficult is it to convert the plant from pulverized coal to natural gas, because it seems like there is more natural gas.
That is a big question. And I think a lot of actually trying to retrofit, you might be able to make use of the steam turbine, but most of the rest of the plant, of the power plant, is geared for solids handling and handling of the particulate emissions and the sulfur emissions. And so there very well might be a case for just mothballing or knocking some of these plants down and putting in an NGTP, which raises all sorts of interesting additional questions.
Let me ask the same question regarding oxygen buses. And pulverized coal. How much does the existing CT plant could be used for oxycombustion. For oxycombustion, that's a matter of some debate and speculation. A lot of people think that if there's enough CO2 in the recycle, you could make use of the existing boiler, but most of the existing boilers run at somewhat less than atmospheric pressure, so there's a potential issue with air infiltration, and then if you get too much nitrogen coming in to the boiler, and so the Future Gen 2 project actually going to be really interesting. I think the plan for that is to actually replace the boiler with an oxy boiler, so a boiler that's been designed to not have that air infiltration problem, but then make use of most of the rest of the balance of plant. But of course, the FCB won't be something that you would need to use anymore. The solid particulate removal won't be something that you would need anymore. And so the land area is currently given over to kind of that part of the plant to be used for the air separation unit. It's actually a good thing because many of the existing plants are very constrained by space. And so you talked about putting a solid absorbent system and an air system in there. One of the questions is, where did it go?
Can I make comments?
Sure.
About running pulverized coal boiler for burning natural gas. It's actually, you can do that because most pulverized coal boilers have natural gas pilot lights. So there's usually natural gas there, and there's sometimes pretty easy to add natural gas burners on the walls of pulverized coal boilers. But the bigger issue actually for the boiler is that natural gas plates are very luminous compared to a coal plate. So the radiant section of a coal burner, of a coal boiler, compared to the convection section of a coal burner, for natural gas boiler, it has a much smaller radiant section, much larger convective section. So burning natural gas in a boiler designed for coal derates the boiler by a significant percent, just because there isn't as much radiant energy from natural gas, because it doesn't have particulates in the flame.
Let's thank David again. And thank you, Jeff. Whoever else is out there. Okay.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.